Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Stephen C. Hayes, who is Nevada Foundation Professor and Director of Clinical Training at the Department of Psychology at the University of Nevada. He's the author of many books, including the popular Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life, which for a while was the number one best-selling self-help book in the US. He's the co-founder of Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, or ACT, as it's more commonly known, and he's going to talk to us today about ACT, what's unique about it, what are its goals, how it pans out in practice, and how it might relate to the middle way. Hello, Stephen. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
I'm glad to be here with you.
Okay, well, maybe we could kick off, Stephen, by you telling us a little bit about your background.
Well, I'm a clinical psychologist, and I also do research in language and cognition. I come from a behavioral background, cognitive behavioral background,
but became
dissatisfied with breadth of the methods there, in particular when I developed my own panic disorder as an assistant professor and found that some of the things that I was taught to do just didn't have enough traction. And it was only when I turned back to things that I had explored inside Eastern traditions and the human potential movement. I'm a child of the 60s and was in California back in the hippy-dippy days and lived on a commune and explored various kinds of Eastern religious ideas. And when I turned back to those traditions and tried to mix them with my more scientific training as a psychologist, I did find traction very quickly with my own problems, and it gave me traction with the clients that I was working with, seeing as a clinical psychologist. And that really fascinated me, that here these ancient wisdom traditions had something very concrete to add to psychotherapy and to behavior change as it applied to myself. So I did a couple early randomized trials to see if was that really true, and found that it was. I put that aside, and for 15 years we published no outcome data at all. We explored instead the processes, the components, the measures, because it seemed to me if we were going to come forward and say something like, you know, that some of these ancient traditions had something very important to say, I had to have my ducks in a row. And then in 1999, we published the ACT book, and since then it's sort of exploded on the scene with all kinds of research and so forth. So that's 30 years in about 2 minutes.
And how did you actually get yourself out there? How did you get that recognition so quickly? Or was it quickly?
In the sense of the impact, you know, the ACT work has really expanded by a community that's built around it. There's an association which doesn't have ACT in the name. It's called the Association for Contextual Behavioral Science. And it has nearly 8,000 members worldwide, half outside of the North America. So it's a worldwide movement. It only started in 2006, so that growth has been very, very rapid.
Yeah.
And I think what it is that because we spent so much time really working out issues of philosophy and measures and components and theory, we have something to contribute to the conversation now that it's arrived. When I was doing this early empirical work in the early 80s, the idea that you could put Eastern thought into Western evidence-based psychotherapy was just not on the table, and there were a few people dabbling in it, but they were speaking very softly because they're afraid that they wouldn't be supported in their home institutions by the funders, the grant givers, the journals, and so forth. But when ACT came forward as a fully developed system right at the turn of the century, we had done so much background work, and the interest was just coming in at that time, the books on acceptance and mindfulness and values and so forth, so that I think people have found something that adds to the contemplative practice traditions, the mindfulness traditions, in an interesting and complementary way. And I think because of that, you've seen a lot of growth. Usually people who come to the work are not wanting to be put in a box, and we don't try to put people into a box. So they continue their compassion-focused meditation or their contemplative work and mix it with what we've been able to develop as a Western science tradition, Inside ACT, or the really what I almost prefer, the larger contextual behavioral science community that is trying to, as we say, kind of a little boldly on our website, create a psychology more worthy of the challenge of the human condition.
And one of those challenges is that the assumption that you commonly found in Western psychology of this idea of healthy normality. Now, that's been quite controversial, hasn't it?
Yeah, you know, I think it's so easy for us to put human suffering into a box. We do it when we use a syndromal label. It's almost as if we had a sorting table, and as long as we have a box for it, and we can put the things in there that somehow we've understood it and we've done something about it. And yet the thing that it cannot explain is the ubiquity of human suffering. Mm-hmm. Even in the developed world, we're not just talking about people who suffer because they don't have enough food to eat or a shelter. We're talking about people who have everything. And in the history of the planet, are almost beyond imagination in the amount of material resources that they have available to them. Not just the billionaires, but just the normal person living in the developed world is living in a way that no one on the planet lived like that just a few hundred years ago. And yet the rates of suicide and suffering and depression and anxiety and substance use and so forth almost outstrips the ability of our health systems to care for people. So I think it's far more plausible to think that what is called normal is actually the source of suffering. And by looking at it that way, we were able to see processes that you can put not just into the therapy room, but into churches and schools and businesses and homes and the organizations that you're part of, that soften them, that humanize them, and that lift people up. And I think that's what the wisdom traditions have tried to do from the beginning. We've part of a whole family of methods that have figured out how to put that message into the healthcare system and even get paid for it, not necessarily very much, but which is, that's new. That's never really been like that in Western society, at least. And I think it's making a profound difference in our culture. And I hope there's kind of a race between these forces, that we can trim back some of the excesses of the materialistic culture that we've created that can be very avoidant and present these kind of bangles in front of people's eyes that draw them off into pathways that are empty. Yeah. And so we're trying to be part of taking a set of assumptions that allow us to go into human need where it exists, which is not just in the people coming in to seek help for behavioral health problems or mental health problems. They're in you and the person sitting next to you.
So it's as much an integrative practice as a therapy then?
Well, in how it's played out, you know, the people who get involved in ACT and see some benefit to it as therapists, and this is one reason why we've seen the growth, is that people are quite buoyed up by the community that builds around that, number one. But number two, the practices themselves are healing and healthy for the providers. And we've done randomized trials on that now. We've got 6 or 7 randomized trials showing that using ACT methods reduces burnout and increases professional engagement, reduces the psychological distress in providers, in the social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, and so on.
Interesting.
And in the same way, when we put it into people's lives, you know, I'm really quite comfortable not using the therapy word. We sometimes call it acceptance and commitment training. Yep. When we go into organizations and business. We have, you know, 60 self-help books in 25 different languages. I've done the calculations. I think there's somewhere around 2.5 million copies of ACT books that are for end users, for normal folks sitting in somebody's home right now. Mm-hmm. And if with a normal multiplier, that means, additional millions, maybe not all read the books cover to cover, but people find things in the work that you can put into your moments. And you can do it quickly. You can do it right now. And part of what I think we do bring to the conversation that's helpful is that we know something about what the processes of change are. We can simplify the message from all the many, many things you can do. There's a small handful of things that are very important to do that if you can cultivate as a practice, will make broader and more flexible the way that you interact with the world. And that's going to pay dividends for you, put you on a path that will evolve you towards the life worth living.
Okay, that sounds fascinating, Tim. So what is ACT then? Can you give us an overview of it?
Sure. Acceptance and commitment therapy or training, and we do go by ACT and not ACT. Yeah. I'm old enough to remember when ECT was very popular, and I'm waiting to be shocked if somebody says ACT around me. We call it ACT. ACT is an evidence-based behavior change method that is based on a contextual, monistic, functional, psychological approach that deploys evidence-based processes for the purposes of creating psychological flexibility. And what we mean by psychological flexibility is being able to do six things to feel your feelings on purpose without being dominated by them, to notice your thoughts in flight and to learn from them but not be entangled with them, to come flexibly into the present moment, being able to allocate attention by your purposes at hand, and to do so as a conscious human being, not just as your set of automatic reactions, and to be able to shift your attention towards what you deeply want to bring into your life as a quality of what you do, towards your values, and build patterns of living, of actions, of behavior that are more and more built around those values. So we call them as acceptance, diffusion, a transcendent sense of self brought into the now, focused on your values and building patterns of committed action. Those things all are the components of psychological flexibility. And it turns out if you work on those six components, your life is going to improve in almost every area that you can think of, because we get in our own way. These are the opposite of each of these six things are kind of cul-de-sacs that we can get into that make it difficult for behavioral systems to evolve in a healthy way.
Yeah.
And so that's we think that we've distilled it down to a workable set of evidence-based processes that can be measured and can be targeted with procedures that make sense and change. And when they change, good things unfold over time. Instead of there's kind of a fool's gold. I mean, there's a lot of things that can look like positive change has happened, and it turns out to actually be negative. Some of the symptom-focused changes that come out of the medicalization of human suffering, for example, can easily be changed by methods that are unhealthy. And so it's good to have a kind of a reliable compass.
Yeah.
And those six processes are a reliable compass. And ACT is nothing more than the evidence-based work attempting to target those.
And how does it differ from, say, other mindfulness-based therapies or practices like MBSR or MBCT?
Well, MBCT and MBSR were built on the wisdom traditions, not just in the focus of the work, but also in the method of the work. And they're based on contemplative practice traditions, which in about a third of our randomized trials, and the percentage actually is going up, we use in ACT. If you were to come to an ACT conference, there would be meditation sessions even there going on, often early in the morning, yoga sessions, things of that kind too. But what we're more interested in are the processes of change that underlie those things, because some of the things that we can do to put the core of the wisdom traditions into, for example, the factory floor, you can do in ways that take 20 seconds or 60 seconds, not in ways that would require sitting, for example, for any period of time, which is very, very difficult. I asked some of my contemplative practice folks of, you know, is this really for Joe Sixpack or is this for the educated elite? And, you know, in the Eastern countries where meditative traditions developed, the monks take alms so that they can do this. The normal folks are not sitting around doing 10-day silent retreats.
Yeah.
They're giving money to the people who are doing it. We're trying to put that into the factory floor. And that's just not going to be the way to open the door. You've got to put something on the factory floor that will take minutes, not 10 days or 3 days. And there's parts of the country, I used to live in the South, if you use the B word, people would leap up and run out of the room. it would be the devil's work to stay there and listen. And so we have to find other ways. And what we do bring, I think, is a whole range of methods that can be deployed and used that are harmonious with the contemplative practice traditions that will focus on the targets, the processes that will change with contemplative practice, and you can then integrate your contemplative practice work in the settings and with the populations for whom people are interested and willing to do it, to establish a practice, with a set of scientific principles that build out and amplify on that, being more flexible in the methods, but focused on the core, focused on the processes of change that occur inside the wisdom traditions, I believe. And so far, we do have now quite a bit of data that the processes of change that you see that account for positive outcomes in MBCT, MBSR, DBT, ACT, all dance around the psychological flexibility set of processes. And if we use mindfulness measures and flexibility measures, they move with our methods, and they move quite similarly to what's happening in MBCT and MBSR. And the people who do better in all of those methods are people who are moving on some of these common core processes. So they're fellow travelers, they're friends and colleagues. They come to the people who are doing this kind of work. They come to our conferences and always have. Zindel Siegels and Mark Williams and so forth from the MBCT wing are regularly there as honored guests, and they're also just come because they're interested. And so we're working together to try to create additional ways to move the ball down the field culturally.
Okay. Well, mindfulness seems to be very much a thing that is a middle class thing, whereas, if you look at studies of people who are suffering from chronic pain, either physical or emotional, is that they're often from underprivileged backgrounds. But that message, certainly in UK, is hard to get that message across. Is that the same problem in the States?
I think so. I think it is true. And it's as I said, I think it's become the province of the educated elite.
Yeah.
And we dare not let it stay there. It's just a kind of a violation of the core of the work to allow that to happen. You can kind of understand why it happens. But I do think that by coming into community and really looking at this in a broader way, we can work together. And it's not just ACT. There's other folks. I think some of the metacognitive therapy people or even motivational interviewing or things like that are touching on things that are part of the larger body of the work. Now, look, I'll give you a concrete example. A thing that we spent a lot of time on in ACT is values as a choice. Mm-hmm. And by values, we mean what are the qualities of your behavior, of your interaction with others and with the world that you want to bring into the world. That's not a hard conversation to have with people who are in lower SES groups. Even we've done randomized trials of ACT for people with developmental disabilities all the way down to IQs of 70. It's not a hard conversation to have with anyone who has enough verbal ability to be able to project a future and to see a link between what they do and the direction in which they're moving. And so if you can have somebody get in touch with what is deeply of importance to them in terms of how they are in the world, and the two ways in on that, one is going to be opening up to the sweet moments that people have had in their life and then looking at what's inside that.
Yeah.
And the other one is to look at their own pain. Mm-hmm. Because part of what's going on in pain is that something somehow is being violated or taken away. And there's underneath that, if you can flip it over, there's yearning for something. So, for example, I said that I had a panic disorder, and a big focus of that was social anxiety. And it took me years of this work to realize that underneath the social anxiety was, and I have family of origin stories, I know why this happened. My dad was an alcoholic, my mom was depressed, obsessive, compulsive, and I'm kind of watching them, and I'm wanting to help them when they're arguing and throwing things and dad's coming home drunk and so forth, and I'm wanting to go and help them and feeling completely inadequate to the task as a young child. It was just not my role, plus it wasn't safe. Well, so here I've made this decision as a young child that I'm going to do something while knowing that I'm not able to. And then here as an assistant professor, I'm developing panic around what? Wanting to do something and feeling as though I'm not able. Yeah. And where does it show up? When I'm in front of other people? Well, of course. Why wouldn't it? You know, the 8-year-old shows up. And I was trying to solve that problem in a way that was tantamount to turning to this yearning that's inside this painful place for contribution and for making a difference. And I was doing something that was tantamount to taking that part of me and telling it to go away and shut up. And that message is so harsh and so dehumanizing. You know, it's no wonder. Thank God for my panic disorder. Because without it, you know, I could have gone on in this kind of sugar soup, you know, just giving me the good stuff, self-objectification for many, many years. And it slowed me down. Mm-hmm. And so my point here is that values are the flip side of your suffering.
Yeah.
And so when you begin to see this, the psychological flexibility concept, it turns out that you can go to that core from any one of those six processes. And as you begin to open up to what you care about, you open up to where you hurt, but you also open up to what brings vitality and meaning and purpose to your life. And now that's a conversation, and there are methods that we can put in there that will directly reach into the hearts and minds of people on the factory floor. We've done randomized trials of ACT for safety in factories.
Yeah.
Where you have these very, you know, hard hat, tough guys, you know, they don't want to wear these sissy things, you know, you're giving me safety belts, look, I'll climb right up with that, I don't even need a belt, you know, I don't need a freaking hat, what do you, you know, and then we get into safety meetings, so the guy who originated this is DJ Moran, and we start having these conversations, and people start standing up and talking about how important their children are to them, and how they want to be there to watch their grandkids get married, and the safety hats and the safety belts begin to change what they are.
Yeah.
They're not an indication of weakness. They're an indication of your care and concern for others, which is something that is deep inside your heart.
Yeah.
And you don't have to go to college to do that. You don't have to be middle class to have that.
No, of course not.
You don't even have to have an IQ that's averaged. That means if you talk, if you're just that far along, you know, we should be able to have methods that will reach your hearts and minds and try to soften and humanize this the journey that you're on with yourself and with others in the human community. So that's the thing I think we bring to the conversation. Now, every teacher, every meditation teacher is going to have right action, going to have values in there, but they're going to do it in a spiritual and religious way. Mm-hmm. And so, and you can't do that to put them in the health system. You cannot, you can't come in as a, nobody anointed you as to be a spiritual and religious leader when you're in a pain clinic.
Yeah.
So, so we have to have another way to have that conversation. And I think, you know, like MBCT, which I love the work, but you're not going to find values in the book because you can't put it in the same way. You need a new way that doesn't look like the way that the contemplative traditions have raised the issue of values. So that's some of the things we can do by distilling this down to common core processes and being flexible about our methods, but being focused about our purpose and working together with the contemplative traditions to amplify them and put them into human culture in some new and different ways.
Okay. Well, another thing related to this, Stephen, is the client-therapist relationship in ACT. It's not one up, is it? There's no real hierarchy there. Would I be right in saying that?
We try to do everything we can to minimize this hierarchy. And by basing our work on the psychology of the normal, that means it's you too, Mr. Therapist, big shot. And so when we train in ACT, the early trainings are usually focused on experiential work. The experiential work is not about just experiential practice and doing therapy. It's about exploring your own experience. And people who are good ACT therapists know how hard it is when it's your stuff. And that makes it a lot softer, that you don't go one up and you don't find yourself doing these crazy things like diffusion is our method for being able to look at literal language instead of just looking at the world structured by it. And we have a couple hundred methods to help people diffuse from, that is to pop the illusion of literal meaning, to diffuse from thoughts. Well, if you don't know how hard it is, you could find yourself in this almost silly position of saying, you shouldn't be so fused to people, which of course is a very fused thing to say. By being on the path yourself and doing the work yourself, when you get in front of another person and you see human suffering, you're seeing a reflection of processes you know about. You're almost looking at a mirror in a way. The person has a unique story and so forth. But if I can give an example, in workshops, we will often drill down to things that people feel struggle with or feel ashamed of or try to hide from others, or things that in their dark moments they focus on and they don't easily share with others. We create a safe enough place that people are willing to at least put their toe in the water and put a single word on a sticky badge that represents something inside that story that they're ready to let go of.
Yeah.
In other words, to out themselves on one of their secrets, like that they're unlovable or stupid or mean or perverted or a liar or untrustworthy or whatever the thing may be. And the badges go on, and I ask people to do it in silence and to not ask questions and to not explain. So they're prohibited from telling any stories about the word that's on the badge. And we get up and we walk around the room and we look at each other's badges. And the great secret is that everybody has the same secrets. You know, at least 95% of what you see could have been on your chest. This is just human beings. Yeah. It is not. I mean, inside the story, inside this ego-based story, ego doesn't just mean up, it can mean down. Like, I suffer more than anyone. I'm so special in my suffering. Nobody suffers. They should make a monument to me, a monument to suffering. Here, therapist, you can help me. You can't, because I know you have the methods, you don't, that will reach me. I'm too tough for you. You know, this is a voice within that pridefully hangs on to suffering as a badge of honor and as a proof of specialness. And it's as common as dirt. It's like air. If you look around you, if you just open your eyes in the grocery store, you're going to see, no, people aren't wearing badges, but you just watch them. You will see suffering all around you. And then, by the way, it's much the same as your own. So
I think also what's interesting with that, you point out that discomfort is inevitable, but the struggling with discomfort is optional.
Yes, exactly. And, to be more precise about it, you would say suffering, pain is universal, but suffering need not be. I think we can unburden ourselves from human suffering, but you have to do it in a very counterintuitive way. There's a sufferer actually gives you the sense of it. The word the first part of that word means to come up or under, and And the ferry part is from a root word that means to carry, like a ferry boat.
Mm.
The suffer part, it's actually the same root as reference. It conveys this idea of coming up under and carrying this burden. Well, what would it take to put that burden down? And part of what it takes to put it down is to inhale it, is to bring it in. We have this idea that we'll put it down when we put it away. But of course, what we're putting away are focuses of our history. We're put away the suffering of an 8-year-old watching his parents fight in a very destructive way. We're trying to put away the sadness of loss, mm-hmm. and of seeing, or the judgments that we will carry when we've betrayed others or have not been there for others. Those things don't get put down. They get, this would be bad English, but they get gotten with. You get with them. You get with them. And learning how to carry pain is part of the process of alleviating suffering. That we can sort of put down that burden that's on us as we sort of expand to include it. And it turns out once it's there, it's not a burden, it's a guide, it's a flashlight into the darkness. The things that we worry about and suffer about, the things that we struggle with, are things that if you can turn them over, give us a guide to meaning and purpose. They're helpful to us. They're actually helpful guides. I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
I do work in substance abuse. We've done randomized controlled trials on shame. But most people who are struggling with substance abuse, and they very often let themselves down, they let their bodies down, they let their families down, they let their communities down. I mean, there's a lot of things that they know they've done wrong inside their addiction.
Yeah.
Sometimes very spectacularly wrong of allowing things to happen to people they love. And it turns out that guilt is a positive ally to change.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't like guilt. Of course, they don't like guilt. I mean, in fact, have another beer, snort something, shoot something. If you're feeling guilty, quick, get rid of it. Of course, but that's the very path that give rise to the things you did that you're guilty about. And shame, no, shame includes this bought into, fused in, ego-based story of how bad you are.
Yeah.
And you're not. You're a human being. You've made mistakes. You've done things that are unhelpful.
Yeah.
That old Christian thing of, hate the sin, love the sinner. So we can negotiate that, and when we finish it, we'll end up with judgments and memories and sensations and so forth as part of the journey, but not as what they say they are, not as what your mind tells you have to do with them. And held properly, they end up being allies, not enemies.
Yeah. I often think of guilt as more of an empathic emotion than shame. For example, say you slept with someone else. If you're feeling shame, you're worried about what other people are thinking about you. Whereas if you feel guilty about it, you're feeling hurt for what you've done to the other person. You empathize with their pain.
No, I agree with that. And actually, I think part of that is this very subtle and very tricky thing, which actually I was. Have been really sort of exploring more recently, which is this: all of our self descriptions, positive and negative, that we buy into, these comparatives, are actually ways of distancing ourselves from others and distinguishing ourselves from others. So it isn't just that I'm bad; it's that I'm badder than.
Yeah.
And so this social extension. I mean, if you just actually take anything, even the positive ones, I'm smart, really comes down to I'm smarter. And as soon as you do that, smarter than what? Smarter than those, or that one, and that one, and that one. As soon as you do that, you've ripped yourself out of the group. you're now feel alienated and disconnected. The same thing happens on the negative side of things. So shame is an emotion that leads to a kind of judgment-based self-attack that pulls you away from people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, and inside that, there's almost this little attachment to specialness. And conversely, if you know, guilt can pull you towards people as you recognize that you do care about people and sometimes you let them down. That's a good thing to know. That's not your enemy to know that.
Yeah.
That's your guide. I mean, it's no more your enemy to know that than it would be your enemy to notice that when you're driving off to the side of the road and away from the paved part of the road, you want to be able to be awake enough to see that, oh no, the driving's not going to be done very well over there. In the same way, if I'm, you know, off from my moral compass, I want to be able to be brought back to the center.
Yeah. Can we just move back to ACT for a little bit? You mentioned that a big part of ACT is the idea that language is part of the problem. Is it the problem-solving, conclusion-jumping, rule-setting aspect of language that you find destructive? For example, I'm thinking of metaphor is also an aspect of language, but you seem to use this very effectively to help people see things from a wider perspective in an integrative way.
Sure. Well, one of the things we did in that 15-year gap is we worked on a theory of language and cognition because we couldn't find one that was adequate to what we were trying to do. And we developed one called relational frame theory, which has its own life in basic psychology and which is doing wonderful things in teaching us how to teach language skills to developing disabled children or establish a sense of self in autistic spectrum disorder children or raise the intelligence even of normal IQ kids or develop measures of implicit cognition and so forth. So relational frame theory is something that ACT co-evolved with, which came out of my laboratory years ago, but has grown to an entire thing. And one of the things that RFT says is that there's kind of two aspects of language. There's an aspect of putting things together into relational networks. Mm-hmm. The basic idea of RFT is that arbitrary relationships, learned arbitrary relationships, are the core of human language, probably evolved initially as an extension of cooperation. We're the only species that do it, by the way.
Yeah.
And you can show it even in 12-month-old babies. But the tool that we evolved, which this simple core, if I could be allowed 2 minutes of geek, yeah. The core of relating, the core of human language, is its bidirectionality. And so, for example, if you learn that a cup is this object, you'll know that this object is called a cup. That's not true of the language-trained chimps or any non-human primate or other non-human animal, but it is true even of 12-month-old babies, human babies. And we think it comes from how social we are. We're the social primates, the eusocial primates. And I show this in workshops by taking an object, giving it a funny name, and then putting it out of reach. And then I reach for it and say its name. And I just stand on stage reaching for it, saying its name. And in about 30 seconds, somebody goes and grabs the objects and gives them to me. Which, of course, is exactly what would have happened.
Yeah.
In early humans, whether the hominids do it, I don't know, but we know that Homo sapiens did because we know that human language, there was a single language on the planet 100,000 years ago. You can look at the changes in the structure of language and go backwards in time and say there was only one language 100,000 years ago.
Isn't there a species of monkey that, you know, they say leopard and the other monkeys jump up the trees, or if they say eagle, then they hide for cover or something like that?
Absolutely, absolutely. Animal communication systems are bidirectional often, and they're wonderfully useful inside the troops. But if you take that monkey and you did that simple experiment I just did, they would fail the test. And we know that because it was done with Sue Savage Rumbaugh and Dwayne Rumbaugh's chimps at Yerkes, the two prides of the troop, Lana and Sherman, the best chimps they had. And, and when they trained in careful work, Neil Dugdale and Fergus Lowe at Wales did this. They came to Yerkes in Atlanta to do the study. When they trained at Yerkes, they used plastic chips instead of signs. a chained object chip, and then they present the chip and see could they pick the object from an array, and they were at chance levels. And then they trained it the other way, chip object, and then could you pick the chip given the object at chance levels?
Yeah.
So there are no species of monkeys that do this. They communicate. But if you actually do things like, for example, the prairie dog that squeaks when it sees the eagle, the prairie dog that listens and runs into the hole, different parts of their brain are lighting up. These are two integrated systems, but they mean something different.
Right.
The squeak run meaning is different than the see the snake or eagle or whatever it is and characteristic sign. What we would be able to do, because we're a cooperative species, is we have an object and some characteristic sign, but initially socially, that sign will then give you the object. That was the example I just used of reaching out, making the sign. And then as it gets internalized, we can have our own back and forth as speakers and listeners. So we can take something, give it a name, and that name will remind us as the object, like that.
Boom.
Well, that's backward conditioning. That doesn't happen in non-humans. It happens like that in humans. Well, so what of it? As this gets built out, it starts as an extension of human cooperation. You can say to, you know, a human far across the ravine and ask them, do you see apples, or bring me an apple? But it immediately creates a psychological challenge. For one thing, anywhere you go, you can now remember painful things by having the signs be presented for them.
Yeah.
In a non-human situation, you would have to actually present the formal properties of the situation in which bad things happened in order to have memory work that way. So, you know, if I shock an animal in the presence of a symbol, and then I bring the symbol in their presence, they'll, of course, respond. But we can, for example, be in a wonderful environment and have somebody remind us of a rape. And suddenly we're back there again. So that's one. That comes just from the early parts of language. But then the next part is, as we built it out, we used language for problem solving. That bidirectionality allowed us to do things. We could, for example, imagine a future that's never been. We can compare things arbitrarily. We can say that, you know, a nickel is smaller than a dime when it certainly is not. And we can say this good outcome is good, is okay, but it would have been much better in imagination if we'd done this other thing. Well, that's great. That's allowed us to kind of take over the planet in a way. But if you can say a nickel is smaller than a dime, you can say, yeah, I made $1 million, but I should have had two.
Yeah.
You know, and every day there's people with everything who are, you know, reaching into the drawer to pull out a gun and shoot their brains out. Every day that happens.
Yeah.
And so we can suffer even amidst plenty. So he'll come back to the core of your question. One of the advantages of taking the time to develop a basic science tradition that tells us some of these processes is we can answer these complex questions of, like, when is language going to be helpful to us and when is it not? And what does it take to put it on a leash? And we found in the RFT labs that one way that we can do it is we can alter the contexts in which language has behavior regulatory power. And we can undermine that power. Conversely, and when we're in a situation in which our problem-solving mode of mind, our judgmental comparative mode of mind is useful when you're doing your taxes or you're trying to figure out what investments to do, I suggest that you do that using your full problem-solving mode of mind. Don't cut off the rest of you, but use it because it's needed there, but not when you're attempting to produce peace of mind, for example. That doesn't come that way, because as soon as you've created yourself as a problem to be solved, you're bought into the idea that something's missing, and that will always be true. So let me give you an example. This is a thing that Titchener did in the turn of the century, and that we were the first to bring it into psychotherapy. We would take something somebody's struggling with. I'm thinking of a group of substance users in a recent randomized trial we did where we were dealing with shame. It was that same trial. And I was running the group, and I asked them to dig down to something that really is hard for them to sit with, you know, that word on tags, yeah, situation. Yeah. inside their addiction. And the group of about eight people negotiate down to the word loser. So they're here in an inpatient facility as eight losers. Yeah. And that punches so hard, it's enough to make them want to, you know, smoke another joint or have another fix. And so we took the word loser and we said it out loud rapidly as a group for 30 seconds. By the end of 30 seconds, it had far less punch. And the next time it came up in your mind, I guarantee you it would have a little distance. You'd be able to look at it more like you might have actually if you had engaged in contemplative practice, so that when a thought came up like that, you'd have that natural skill to get a little bit of distance, psychological distance, between the part of you that's aware of the thought and the thought itself. You can do that in 30 seconds. And no, of course, in normal language, it will disappear back into the illusion of literal meaning. But not with that memory gone away. There's that little part that reminds you that, oh, by the way, these are just sounds. Oh, by the way, this is an arbitrary relationship. The things we call things aren't the things themselves. And we created a context in which the function of the word goes down. It's still, you still understand what loser means. Well, I get notes. I got a note from Japan here about 2 years ago. Somebody says, like, you know, I was born into a Buddhist family and I've been meditating my whole life. And I read Get Out of Your Mind and I saw this little thing about repeating words. And I took a word that was really punching me, pushing me around, and repeated it. And in 30 seconds, I saw something that I hadn't seen in 40 years of meditation, that there's, this is what I'm doing when I'm doing meditation well.
Yeah.
I thought, this is very, very cool. And it's not that they were saying that the contemplative work was replaced by a 30-second exercise. It was just a little guide of this little piece of many, many, many things that happened in contemplative practice that you can catch that is part of the liberation process that happens when contemplative practice works well. And I think that's really, really cool. That's an example of what it meant at the very beginning. If we can bring these tiny little methods that, by the way, you can put at the factory floor. DJ Moran, when he's doing his safety things, he gets the group to talk about what is the word that is punchy when they're using all of their safety gear that would tell them to not. And they may negotiate down to something like sissy.
Yeah.
Okay. And then they'll all sit as a group and they'll go sissy, 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 sissy. And then they'll stand up and put on their freaking hard hats.
Yeah, brilliant.
You know, be more likely to put on their hard hats because of that tiny little crack in the system that you can have the thought that you're a sissy and it doesn't mean you have to do what your mind says. You can put your mind on a leash.
Yeah.
And use it as a tool when it's useful, but not have it, you know, put you on a leash and just lead you off the edge of a cliff. And, you know, okay, I'm not going to wear my hard hat. And then the guy above me drops a tool. And, you know, I'm going to, my teenage son is not going to, you know, have his new car. He's going to be pushing his dad away around in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is something that normal people can understand and that they care about. We can reach normal folks.
Yeah.
With messages that are deep inside our wisdom traditions, but we're going to have to go in with a variety of methods to open up the door to that space, and not just using the B word and not just, you know, silent retreats and so forth. There are many ways into this space, and then once there, all of these other things will make more sense to people, and I think you will see how they work hand in hand.
Yeah, that's really inspiring, Stephen. Well, just sticking to the topic of language, you know, in preparing for this interview, I've been looking through the literature about ACT, and a lot of it seems to be couched very much in incremental and provisional terms, like you often using gerunds and avoiding absolute terms. Is this part of the ethos?
Yeah, we do. We're careful about categories and about summative comparisons. And what we're trying to do, what diffusion is about, this little piece that the Titchener exercise opens us up to, but we have hundreds of methods. And in fact, and you mentioned Get Out of Your Mind Into Your Life, I challenge readers to come up with methods of their own, new ones, and they do, and they mail them to me and so forth, and they're very creative. Once you see how to bring this little puppy to put it on a leash, this little mental puppy called our own minds, there's a myriad of ways to do it. But, you know, kind of as you do that, what's critical about it is that you begin to see languaging as a human process. It's a thing we do. Mm-hmm. And you begin to see it in flight, in process. That's a gerund. Yeah. That's an ing.
Yeah.
We're thinking. We're relating. We're comparing. And there's a person aware of that. When you simply allow your mind, you take it off the leash and you allow it to sort of become your master, and especially the storied self, the conceptualized self and the conceptualized other, I'm a person who, and you're a person who, and then we've got like these helmets on that are, you know, constantly directing our attention, and we have no awareness of the fact that we're wearing a helmet at all, that we've put anything on us. Because the story doesn't story about itself as a story. The ego doesn't say, oh, by the way, I'm actively creating an illusion here for you so that you can disappear into your story. It just creates the illusion, then you disappear into the story. So you'll see in the ACT work as a projection of this quality of wanting to constantly notice language as a process, changes in just the normal discourse. I'll give you an example. It turns out this is helpful. We've done little component analyses on these things, such as that word repetition. We've done three or four, oh golly, maybe half a dozen studies on that. You know, if we can do things like, I'm having the thought that, and then we say it. Just presenting that, which is actually more true. If you have a thought, just say what the thought is. But say it in a way that's true to the actual experience. I had this thought, or I'm having the thought that. There was a study done where we did fMRI work with a person taking self-relevant thoughts that were judgmental, like I'm bad, and then having the same thing phrased how what actually happened when people experienced it, which is I'm having the thought that I'm bad. And that's what happened, of course. People didn't experience being bad. They experienced having the thought that they're bad, right? Well, just say that.
Yeah.
And it turns out your brain lights up completely differently. And it's far less likely to evoke this kind of automatic behaviors that being able to sort of catch the storied self and sort of just notice it. And now I'm saying this about myself. So in therapy, in these early transcripts, you'll say things like, well, what does your mind have to say about that? Well, you wouldn't normally say that to somebody.
Yeah.
But if you put it into therapy and you can do it before you've given any big rationale, you haven't told them anything, it's just common sense language. People understand it. They won't object to it. There's going to be a little gap because now you're asking them, this conscious human being, to look at this relational engine that they carry around that allowed us to do all this wonderful problem-solving kind of skills, but that takes over our psychology and drives us off the edge of cliffs. Sometimes we will say things like, you know, there's four of us in here. There's you, me, your mind, and my mind. The problem is those two are listening. But why don't we have a conversation? You know, that kind of little kind of ways of helping to pop through the bubble.
Yeah, yeah.
That we live inside as normal languaging creatures. So I think it allows a kind of a use of language that helps us constantly to be aware of language as a process,
yeah,
instead of just seeing the world structured by that network,
okay,
and missing the structuring.
Well, that ties in very much with our approach in the Middle Way Society. So, and that brings me to my final question. Stephen, what is your understanding of the Middle Way, and how do you think it might relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I think I don't know much about your society, because I've gone and looked at the website. I'm very interested in what you have there and the very nice arrangement of podcasts and so forth. And I see the heart of what you're doing. But You know, I think part of this kind of the middle way, if you just look at how the Eastern traditions are coming into the Western culture, is that we're going to have to find a way that is not simply this kind of aesthetic dedication to a spiritual tradition beyond our ability to function in and with the world. Yeah. You know, after the ecstasy, the laundry kind of problem that Jack Kornfield is talking about. I mean, I respect that tradition. I think it's fine if people want to pursue it. But what we're trying to do is to put into normal Western culture a sensitivity that's inside these wisdom traditions. And this other way, this very materialistic and hedonistic and path that our capitalist and materialist culture has put us on. I think many, many, many people understand that there's a quality of mindlessness to it and of recklessness to it, mm-hmm. That you can see in everything from the rise of human suffering in Western civilization to the rise of the levels of the seas that will be visiting your grandchildren as a result of the things we've done to our mother planet in order to pursue that agenda. So I just take this middle path to be one in which we can bring these traditions together into the lives of normal human beings and soften and humanize our journey, reducing objectification and dehumanization of ourselves and others, you know, coming into the present in a way that's aware and flexible, and being able to carry our past with its painful history, but being able to learn from that and direct our lives towards the qualities of living that we want to bring into the world in the limited time that we have here. That seems to me kind of a balanced place to sit. Yeah. That gives us a place for Western science traditions and contemplative traditions, and for the role of material things on the one hand, but the importance of peace of mind and wholeness on the other. And finding a way to do that, I my game is to find a way to do that that is Western science based and that tries to find the components and elements and processes that we can focus on and build new methods around. And I'm excited to see, can we come up with new ways of bringing this middle path into existence that will fit the moments of people's lives here and now? And I think we're making progress on that. And I say we, I'm not talking about the ACT folks, I think we're part of it, but I'm talking about this almost cultural shift as people try to create modern minds for the modern world. Mm-hmm. In a world in which you can turn on your television screen and see suffering around the world at any level of detail that you can imagine, when you can hear about things that are going on that are horrible constantly and see it, we have to find a way to carry that without numbing and without objectification and without separation. We can't just afford to say, well, let's close the borders and let the Ebola crisis burn itself out. If it takes the whole continent down and millions of people die, at least they won't be, you know, getting on planes and coming to our country. I mean, we are just not going to, we cannot live in a world that is like that. So if we're going to bring compassion and mindfulness into a world in which we're constantly being exposed to what's going on around the world, we've got to find a way to create more flexible minds that can maintain their balance inside the cacophony. And I think the contemplative traditions are providing a flashlight forward. But I do think we need additional means to be able to bring the core of that message into our homes and clinics and schools and communities and into our culture.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Stephen. Anyway, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you, Barry. It's really, really been fun.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewayphilosophy.com. www.middlewaysociety.org.